It's a joy to be with you today. We had the first opportunity to be here some years ago at Abby's installation, and then we were visiting a couple of weeks ago. We serve the church in Leesburg, and since we live in Frederick, we have the opportunity to wave to you folks each time we pass by on Route 15. Hello, Frederick. This weekend, we celebrate Memorial Day. It's a holiday established after the Civil War as Decoration Day, and perhaps it's also been known as Remembrance Day. It's a time for decorating the graves of the Union dead in its origins. But the wars have kept on coming. And today on Memorial Day, we remember all of our dead from all of our wars over so many years. So for us as a people of faith, it's also a time for pondering how, in the words of Archibald MacLeish, how to give their lives meaning. It begins with remembering. Remembering not just the horror of war and the deaths of our loved ones, but the fullness of the lives they did not get to live and to share with us. It continues with pondering how we can live our lives so that we do not inflict war on anyone else. And a good place to begin our pondering is with Lao Tse's insistence that peace in the world begins with peace in our hearts. What might peace in our hearts look like? Where might it begin?
It might begin as it did for Jim Lawson, in this story told by reporter David Halberstam. Halberstam was a 25-year-old reporter, a mere pup, when he was assigned to cover our country's epical civil rights movement. In 1998, he published a book called The Children, and I commend it to you. It's one of the most powerful books I have ever read, and it is a story of heroes. It is the story of young black college students who changed history through their dedication to nonviolence. One of its leaders, was Jim Lawson, then a role model for the others. How did peace in the heart begin for him? When Jim was about 10 years old, he told Halberstam he loved sitting in the kitchen and talking with his mother while she was preparing supper. One day, his mother sent him out on an errand. On the way, he passed a car that was sitting there with its windows down and a young white boy of 5 or 6 years old standing up on the back seat. As Jim walked by, the young boy at 5 or 6 called out, "Hey, nigger!" Jim turned around, charged over to that car, reached to the window, and slapped that boy as hard as he could. Jim's father, an Old Testament minister, had taught all of his children to retaliate when attacked first, an eye for an eye. His mother was cooking. Her back was turned to him, but he could hear her words clearly. What good did that do, Jimmy? Halberstam writes, everything in his life, he later remembered, seemed to change at that moment. Everything seemed completely still in that kitchen. He was absolutely surprised by her response. Then she began telling him how much he was loved by her and his father and his siblings and by God. You are going to have a good life, Jimmy. With all that good, with all that love, what harm does that stupid insult do? It's nothing, Jimmy. It's empty. That child is gone. You will never see him again. You do not even know his name. Jim was stunned. His whole life changed in that moment. He vowed never to hit anyone again if he could help it. There had to be a better way. Years later, he would look back at that moment as the beginning of his deep commitment to nonviolence.
War is intentional, organized violence. Sometimes it begins with strategic calculation, but most of the time we justify it as our response to someone else's attack on us. Sometimes even an attack centuries ago passed on from generation to generation in stories. If it were not for these threats and attacks and remembered attacks, it would be astonishing on the surface of things that we would even think about saying to each other, let's settle things by seeing who can kill the most on the other side, who can destroy the most, or even to use this as a threat as we negotiate. But in our remembering of these attacks and the fear we allow to build up in our hearts of future attacks, we legitimate the threat of war as a tool of national policy. We thus fuel massive arms buildups that distort our economies and perpetuate the illusion that we are inevitably enemies. And it must always be so. We put our lives and our children's lives at risk. We risk the future of our planet when we could instead devote ourselves to healing these ancient wounds, avoiding new ones and negotiating a peaceful resolution of our conflicts. Sometimes we'll still find ourselves drawn into war. Some things may be worth fighting to end, like genocide, and some conflicts have come too far already to head off, perhaps. But we could avoid so many, and in place of win-lose, find ourselves winners on both sides. I can remember my father telling of the wild enthusiasm that greeted our country's entry into the First World War. Feeling that they were losing, the Germans had extended their submarine warfare to all shipping, not just the Allied shipping. Up to then, President Wilson had tried hard to keep America out of war. In fact, he insisted on trading with both sides. But now, Americans felt attacked. On Wilson's initiative, Congress declared war. Students on my father's campus, like students all over the country, rushed to enlist. And the tide of warfare turned in the year that followed. Just a year later, though after 4 exhausting years of trench warfare in Europe, the fighting ended. But the peace conference that followed imposed enormous reparations, unbearable reparations on Germany. And the seeds of Hitler's rise to power and another world war were laid. But America turned to isolationism, and President Wilson's project to establish a League of Nations to prevent future wars was destined to fail when he was unable to get his own country to ratify it. We had won the war, but turned away from active engagement in building a more peaceful world.
That's the way it is with wars. They begin with shouts and cheers. They end with relief and exhaustion and disillusionment. In between, there's not much to celebrate. And afterwards, though we may eventually manage to embrace our former enemies, as we have with Germany and Japan, we soon found ourselves fighting again with someone else. War is no cure for war. Can we humans never accept that we are all brothers and sisters across all the borders that divide us? Can we never learn that the time to lay the groundwork for peace is long before we are faced with war? What we want to say is that although some may believe that war is sometimes justified, and some may believe that it is never justified, The way to give meaning to the deaths of those we remember today is to devote our passion and energy to building the foundation for peace, which is a world based on justice, in which we commit to settling our differences through negotiation. But most of all, our challenge, yours and mine, is to build peace in our hearts, to look at our own attitudes toward violence and war. As we learn to deal peacefully with our anger and frustration in the small things of our lives, we'll be less ready to send off our young to use guns and bombs to vent our anger and frustration over the larger conflicts we face. As we remember those whose graves we decorate this weekend, we'll realize that the best way to translate the never again we feel in our hearts is to strengthen the foundations of peace. As we look into our hearts, we may begin to see that part of the inner conflict we feel about violence and war may stem from fears, our own fears, that make us vulnerable to the cries of political leaders, that our problems are the fault of others, of people, other people and other nations. In response, too often, we begin to see them as enemies and to demonize them. Soon, we are ready to fight. Even we Unitarians, maybe not so much while war is not going on, but when war is going on, it's hard not to succumb to the thought that somehow we need to pull together in this fight. Within our hearts, our fear is at war with our longing for peace. Fear is not the only reason we fight, but it's a big one, and one that we can work on. For when we learn to face our fears and manage our pride, we may find that we don't need to be afraid. There are peaceful ways to settle our differences. We cannot, of course, tell the world, would you just slow down? Wait for a moment, I've got some inner work to do. Life goes on around us, and our own lives go on. We face decisions about conflict and violence each day in the public sphere. A struggle for inward and outward peace must be a concurrent, interwoven effort. But even to approach the public effort in an awareness of our need to sustain peace in our own hearts can make a powerful difference in our judgment, our strength, and our effectiveness. It may help to protect us from the risk of being taken in by the lure of military glamour and heroism, and the rush of seeing ourselves as number one among the nations. It will help us to hear the call of our hearts to recognize our common humanity across all the differences that divide us, across the oceans and around the world.
The church is a good place to begin. In recent years, our Unitarian Universalist Association has engaged in a long-term study of peace. There is a DVD about it called Creating Peace, A Call to Commitment and Action. Through examples of what our UU congregations are doing and interviews with UU leaders, it challenges us to work for peace, not just at the level of public policy, but in the way we interact within our congregations and the way we reach out to others in our communities. It's powerful stuff. And it's something I need in my own life, lest I yield to the temptation just to tell you from the pulpit what you out there in the pews should do, as ministers are prone to do. I too need that inward peace. What might it look like if we began to live from peace in our hearts? How might we begin? Certainly it's not about imposing a top-down set of rules. Grassroots guidelines can be more helpful, but the ultimate goal is to nurture an inward sense of caring for each other. In the imagery of Isaiah, it's not about what's written on stone tablets, it's about what's written in our hearts. A goal of living peacefully in our congregations might mean a commitment to practice the skills of listening to each other, not just to each other's preliminary opinions, but for what lies beneath those opinions, the things we really care about. It might mean taking the time to build consensus instead of quickly voting, not agreement on every detail, but a shared sense of what's best for the congregation as a whole, for the sake of which we might be ready in time to let go of our initial preferences. With that in common, the formalities of Robert's rules may begin to seem unnecessary. Gradually, our goal is to build for ourselves a sense of groundedness, grounded in ourselves, in our relationship with the universe, with others, grounded in our relationship with life itself. This is a lifelong journey of personal and spiritual growth. Grounded in this sense of who we are and whose we are, we no longer find it necessary to prevail over others. We realize that in coming together with others, we have already won. All of us, together.
When I think of people who have modeled this sense of inward groundedness, I think of Gandhi. I think of Dr. King. And I think of Jim Lawson. Some years ago, John and I took a bus tour of places where the struggle for civil rights in America was acted out in the 1950s and 60s. A man named Bernard Lafayette was our guide. Some of you may remember that name, but I suspect not too many. Back in the 60s, Lafayette was studying to be a minister. When he began coming to hear Jim Lawson speak about nonviolent protest. Now, he knew that he could fake it, but underneath he knew he had feelings of rage and hatred. Jim Lawson said that wasn't good enough. He had to find a way to actually love people, even while they were beating him. Yeah. He had to stop worrying about his manhood, about looking like a sissy, and turn his heart around. And Lafayette was not sure that he could do that. I'm not sure that I could do that. But one day he joined a group of students walking to a protest over segregated lunch counters. Suddenly a group of white toughs attacked another young man he knew, Solomon Gort. He saw them beating and kicking Gort. Immediately his training from Jim Lawson kicked in. He managed to throw himself on top of Gort so that they would turn their blows and their kicks on him. Just then, Jim Lawson sauntered over, confident, contained. The leader of the white boys was dressed in a black leather jacket. He wore his hair all greased back, like Elvis. The white boy was enraged at Jim's coolness, and he spat on him. Jim looked at him and said, "Do you have a handkerchief?" Nonplussed, the boy took one out of his pocket and handed it to him. Jim wiped off the spit as best he could, and then he tried to strike up a conversation. He had noticed the boy's leather jacket. "Did he have a motorcycle?" "Well, yes, I do. A Harley?" With that, they began to discuss motorcycles, horsepower. Meanwhile, with their attacker's attention diverted, Lafayette and Gort got up, started walking again. Halberstam writes, "In that brief, frightening moment, Jim managed to find a subject they both shared and used it in a way that made each of them more human in the eyes of the other. As they walked away, Jim waved at the man, and the man remained still, neither accepting the friendship, but nor, for that matter, rejecting it." Is that not our goal? in our encounters with other people and nations alike, to discover our common humanity, a humanity that will still move us to settle our differences peacefully rather than with guns and bombs. For Jim Lawson, peace had begun in his heart. Those many years before, at his mother's kitchen table. It was lived out in the face of violence on the streets of the civil rights struggle not so long after. For the rest of his life, Jim has modeled and taught the meaning of nonviolence as a pastor and as a teacher. As this weekend, we remember those who have died defending our nation, as we contemplate how we can give meaning to their deaths, could there be any more powerful example than this? If there is to be peace anywhere, there must be peace in the heart. May peace begin in our hearts and grow stronger and stronger and stronger every day. Every day of our lives.